To put it plainly, effective solutions to improve healthcare are hardly ever one size fits all. This is especially true for rural areas, where community members and the healthcare providers that serve them are actively navigating a host of challenges related to healthcare access, quality, costs, and outcomes. To achieve the lasting positive change that the 60 million people in rural America deserve, we must get more creative, more tailored, and more adaptive with how we approach rural health. As we consider how to best design and implement innovative solutions, we can learn from organizations and individuals that have been doing the work to think outside the box for rural health. Understanding their successes and the lessons they've learned will help us to better serve rural communities now and in the future. For this conversation, I'm pleased to have two remarkable rural health leaders join me to discuss their firsthand experiences in designing, implementing, and learning from innovative approaches to improving rural health. Together, we will discuss a path forward that allows us to build on their experiences and create opportunities to put such solutions into practice. I'm Dr. Erica Rogan, a director in Federal Healthcare Advisory at KPMG and host of this edition of Framing Health's Future, an initiative from the federal health leaders at KPMG. I'm pleased to have with me today Jalene Carpenter, President and CEO of the Nebraska Healthcare Association, and Rochelle Schultz, President and CEO of Winona Health in Southeast Minnesota. Well, thank you both for joining me today. I'm really excited to hear about your experiences and your learnings on this topic of innovating for rural health. So our theme for today's conversation is thinking differently to address rural challenges. And before we get into the weeds of what that might look like in practice, I'd love to hear what innovation in rural health and healthcare means to each of you. Rochelle, let's start with you. As a rural hospital and system leader, what does innovation mean to you?
The way I sort of think about this is that my organization is over 130 years old. I've been serving our community, you know, throughout that time. And, you know, I remind people, like, we don't practice medicine like we did 100 years ago or 75 years ago or 50 years ago. And so things are constantly changing. And I think about innovation as being a lot of about reinventing ourselves. It's about constant change. It's about piloting things, experimenting, you know, having some bold ideas, having the courage to, you know, be different and just try stuff. You know, not everything will work and we don't have to be perfect, but there is forward motion. And how do we continue to evolve? How do we continue to learn individually and as an organization? And how are we, you know, sort of constantly growing. So growing doesn't have to be how many facilities do you have or how many this or that, you know, even just our own knowledge and capacity for problem solving, for what are the needs of our community, those change. So ultimately, innovation is about change. And I think it's just embracing that and not getting hung up on, like, nobody likes to change because we're doing it all the time, whether we think about it or not. And just, you know, having more fun with it and maybe pushing ourselves a little bit more, maybe push the boundaries out a little bit.
Yeah, I think that's so important, that concept of forward motion, because it's not necessarily a straight line, right? You might move back a little bit and then move forward, but you're always going in that new direction. And those ideas that you mentioned about having courage and experimenting, I definitely want to come back to those as we talk about maybe some examples that you've had in your organization. But Jalene, I wanted to bring to you, I know that there must be some special considerations when it comes to supporting care for older adults in nursing homes, in assisted living communities. And that would be on top of the unique rural context as well. So when we think about kind of those potential layers of complexity, how do you think about this concept of innovating in rural health?
You know, it's interesting because we say innovation, and I think a lot of people automatically think you must be talking about technology. Like you have to implement new technology to be innovating. And there are times that that's appropriate. We've come a long way when it comes to fall reduction and even the utilization of telehealth in rural when it comes to particular populations that reside in nursing homes and assisted living. But, you know, Rochelle hit it great. It's not always about a new technology. It's about taking what are our greatest struggles, whether that's workforce or access, and looking at it and looking at it from a different lens and saying, you know, how can we approach this problem in a new way? And typically that means stepping out of our comfort zone and being willing to take some risks. And I think that's what innovation is. Innovation is that you're willing to take a risk to the problem that is most pressing.
Absolutely. And it is not always easy to take those risks, right? And so we'll definitely talk too about what organizations might need or look for in order to be able to do that and to balance maybe the risk with potential benefits. So I think that's a really great thread that we'll want to have through our conversation as well. And throughout our podcast series on rural health, one of the key learnings that we've uncovered is that formulaic approaches to rural health seldom lead to the success that we're hoping for. Decision makers might not always feel equipped, though, to experiment or go down these unfamiliar paths that you're both talking about. So what cultural or operational shifts, Rochelle, do you think that we need to encourage for more innovation and creative problem solving in a setting such as yours?
Again, the way that I have approached this, probably in the early years when I first came, because I think about it as like continuous improvement, right? Or, you know, pursuit of excellence or, you know, the various ways that, you know, we can talk about this. And I think it's about building that capacity to change, to evolve, to learn, and to grow within your organization. But you know, I didn't want it to be like all over the place. So it's like, what's the infrastructure? What's the training? You know, who's expected to do this? You know, some organizations might be, it's a top down, you know, approach, or we tell you what to do. And the approach that we took, which actually was both culturally a shift for us as well as operationally, we ended up calling it our continuous systems improvement or CSI approach. And actually, we would say that's our secret sauce. But it was, you know, like lean principles and having a platform, right? So that we could like teach the tools. So it's not just like go have some good ideas and go practice some stuff, but like how do you approach problem solving? How do you think about defining the problem? What problem are you trying to solve? So that we're clear about, you know, what we're trying to do, gathering data about it, really understanding your problem. You know, I don't know that a lot of this stuff is taught in a lot of different, you know, types of programs, you know. I think it naturally goes into what clinicians are used to from the standpoint of like, how do I diagnose something, right? You know, so I have to gather data. I have to understand the problem. I have to, you know, maybe try some different interventions to see, you know, what works. So I think there's parallels in all of that. But what I wanted to do is really infuse throughout the whole organization, just that this is just what we do. This is just how we do it. So it's not like, oh, today's an innovation day. Let's go have some good ideas, or only this one group gets to do it. That it's really about all of us bringing our talent into play to help the organization move forward, you know, to enhance our ability to meet our mission.
I love that. I love this idea of embedding innovation right throughout the organization, as well as maybe providing a methodology or a little bit of structure to think innovatively, which sounds like some unique thinking on being able to problem solve in a creative way, and also equipping your team, your staff with those tools and the ability to think creatively. Jaylene, are there any other additional shifts, or do you see similar kind of cultural shifts needed in the long-term care space?
Yeah, particularly when you think about rural long-term care, mm-hmm. I definitely think not looking at a single operation, but looking holistically at the rural part of our state, we have communities as small as 500 people that has a nursing home that is serving those elders. And when we look at those counties, we look at those populations, what's interesting is most of the time, 40 to 50% of their population is age 65 and older. So culturally, you know, historically, you would have thought to yourself, like, there's people aging, but there's also younger people who are able to care for them. That doesn't exist as much. Culturally, we have shifted. So the population in our rural part of our state, they can be those who live alone, but they are most likely those who are aging. So I say all that from a cultural perspective. One of the things that we in long-term care have to do is to start to break down what I would call silos on what, you know, what we think of as like where people need to fit in, like only in one of these things when we think about somebody aging. And I like to tell people to be forward thinking, you have to stop thinking in a silo. You can't think of someone's at home and then they're automatically going to go to a nursing home. And then it's like a one directional. And it's not. It's very fluid, right? There's a lot that has to go in. And when you're a very small rural community, that means your nursing home is playing all of those pieces, right? And so one of those silos is having that community engagement and culturally ensuring that, and healthcare sometimes we're overtly protective of our operation, you know, and we don't like to sometimes bring in our community or ask for help from the community. But what we see of those nursing homes and assisted livings that are thriving, it's because they took that barrier away and that sort of cultural divide, and they brought the community in, and that's what's kept them successful.
Have you found, Jaylene, that breaking down of the silos is sustainable, or does it seem like that might be one-off, you know, for particular initiatives?
I think we're going to talk about this as we go through of like, how does the federal government play into this? When I look 5 to 15 years down the road, the sustainability of rural long-term care access is going to come down to removing those silos. Mm-hmm. Because you're going to have to be more than a nursing home to survive. So I think it's actually the solution to moving forward versus just an initiative.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's really important, I think, as we're thinking about innovating and also going across sector, across provider types, thinking at the community level, as you mentioned, such an important takeaway, I think, as we consider improving rural health for sure. So I'd like to move us from the conceptual to more of the practical here. And I'd love to hear from each of you an example of an approach that maybe you took or that you saw in the field that you thought was truly innovative or unexpected. What was it? How did it play out? Are there any key takeaways from that experience that have really stuck with you? Jaylene, let's stick with you for this. I'd love to hear an example from what you've seen maybe within your membership.
There's a couple of things. Intergenerational care has been something that we've had providers embrace. And it's, you know, you look at it as you're trying to solve your workforce crisis by ensuring that individuals have access to a daycare so that they can be working. And when you have a very small community, that has been successful. And we have operations in the state where they've been doing it for 15 years. And it's definitely been a positive. What I would say is we tried to build on that and say, okay, how can we take that the next step forward? But we think workforce is our greatest challenge. And how can we ensure that we are getting to youth that will potentially want to work in our facilities one day? So we partnered with our hospital association to create what's called the Healthcare Careers Pipeline Initiative. And it's an after-school curriculum program that's grades 3 through 6. And essentially what it does is it teaches those kids about health science careers. And it does. I mean, it goes everything from a phlebotomist to a doctor, but it uses the words assisted living and nursing home. And, you know, we're trying to take this concept of intergenerational, but also like, how do we educate kids on this is a great career field? And it's been fantastic because it has grown from our pilot of 3 sites to where we have 48 sites, and there have been 3,700 kids who have been through this curriculum.
Wow.
And I just think about like the impact that will hopefully have. It's not immediate, but it's something that, you know, when we think about that workforce challenge, like they're trying to approach it in a new way.
Wow. And so fascinating to get at that younger age group before they are in college or selected a major for something, and to really get at the potential workforce so young and share with them potential careers that maybe they would not have thought of otherwise. So what a great idea and concept to bring forward. I'm wondering how that came to be, Jaylene. Could you share a little bit about how you established those partnerships and kind of the origin of that program?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it all comes down to relationships. But when we thought about our healthcare problem, our biggest challenge in Nebraska is workforce. And part of the workforce crisis is retaining people in their community. So if we can show people that the kids that there's a job in your community by them going through the after-school program, touring the hospital, touring the nursing home in town, you know, that's beneficial. And it actually started back with a conversation from one of our quality partners, which is an organization called Medica. And they said, we want to do something that will benefit the communities. And we had this sort of idea circling around a summer camp, or how do you get kids excited about healthcare? And that's when the Hospital Association came in, and the Medical Association, and they're like, what if we created curriculum? Yeah, you know, how can we kind of get this ball rolling? So it honestly took the strengths of all of our associations and all of us agreeing that workforce is our primary objective. And it's, if we can get kids to go into any form of healthcare, that's benefiting our entire state. And it's also benefiting all of our associations.
And you talked about some of the reach that the program has had already. How did you and your partners know that this was successful? Was it just about uptake, or were there other kind of measures or things you were looking for that let you know that this was on a good track?
Definitely the uptake. So after the launch of the pilot, the feedback that we got, and then the response. And the response outside of metro areas, you know, looking, we have it all across our state. So these sites are in small towns, large towns, but it's literally spread all across the state. And the stories that we continue to hear about the engagement and the excitement is one of the things. But the fact that we have capped this year our growth, there's more people who want to get going, but you know, there's only so much you can do from a, this is all funded through our foundations. And so we have to raise money in order to have the supplies to keep growing. And also just the capacity within the associations to be able to handle, you know, that component to it.
Wow. Well, that's, I guess, a good problem to have, right? That you have such interest in the program and working to address that interest. That's really great. Rochelle, I would love to hear an example that might be top of mind for you of innovation and how an example may have played out with your system.
So the one that I wanted to share was our community care network. And this was several years ago. And it's the evolution. It goes back to like what you know at the time and then how you kind of continue to evolve things. And we developed this approach really at the very beginning of doing our population health value-based approaches. With this, with the understanding that, you know, we got to figure out what is this, you know, because that was in the early days before we even heard, you know, a whole lot about it. And like, how is this going to work? And can it be done? And all of those things. So what we did is we partnered with the one of the local universities and developed a curriculum along with them to take juniors and seniors at the university to become health coaches. And what they became then after they graduated from that class is then we would assign them a particular patient. And the patients that we were looking at were those that were frequently in our emergency room or frequently admitted to the hospital. And so what we knew, and as we were kind of getting into this work, was we know what happens when they're here within our walls. We know we can heal them, we can fix them up, and then we send them home. And we have no visibility to anything that's happening after that. Mm-hmm. And so all this stuff kind of comes in and we sort of patch and you know, and fix. And then we just kind of have that hamster wheel. So this was for us. And I think a lot of what value-based is about or pop health is about is like, let's go back or, you know, upstream. Let's figure out what are some of these root causes, you know, causing people to come in and let's start fixing those. So that's, mm-hmm. that was our thought process around doing all of this. So these students became our eyes and ears. They're not clinicians. They are not to be doing clinical interventions and things like that. But they would partner up with these patients. Now, I would also tell you that a lot of these patients are, they could be a little bit more challenging because a lot of them have been let down by other systems, you know, around that, mm-hmm. you know, just cause them to come into the safety net that's, you know, the emergency room and then ultimately the hospital. But, you know, we go out. So we're in the home now. We see what's going on. We can tell they don't take their medications because they didn't buy their medications because they didn't have money to buy their medications. They get sick because they, you know, they don't have heat on because they can't afford to pay their heating bill. There could be family dynamics that are happening. There's just a whole host of things that, you know, were going on. A lot that we found were like medication compliance, just understanding what to, you know, to do. Of it was, you know, maybe it was people with diabetes who really didn't understand the diet they needed to be eating and, you know, just needed some, you know, help and some support. So this isn't trying to go change people wholesale and say, hey, you're not being a good patient here. You better, you know, start doing these things. But it was to understand, like, really in the life of a patient, what is it that they do, you know? And these coaches, they would meet with them once a week. And they might go play cards. They might meet them for coffee. They might, you know, go for a walk around the lake. And we're just sort of a social connection. And that social isolation issue for elders is like a big deal. And it was amazing to me that an hour a week would make the difference that it did. Students were part of our care team. They'd come back. They would, you know, get coaching and input, you know, from the rest of the clinical team. If they did go out to a site and there was something really, you know, awry, they could call immediately the nurse or whoever, and we would intervene. And, you know, the stories of all of that, you know, that came out of that, not only did we see like reductions in, you know, ER visits, we saw reductions in repeat admissions, you know, we did a little white paper, the whole cost of care came down for that particular, you know, population. We saw people, you know, thriving, being more engaged in the community, getting out on their own, you know, developing new relationships, all of the things that help people just be engaged members, you know, of the community that they live in. And it really didn't take a whole lot. These students were all volunteers. And, you know, my hope was like, they, number one, they get exposure to sort of the healthcare part of it. They also may volunteer, you know, even more going forward. So we were impacting their lives, you know, as well. You know, these relationships that they had with the folks that they were kind of partnered with went beyond the 1 or 2 years, you know, that they, you know, were their health coach. And it's a small intervention in some ways, but I think we underestimate sometimes that those like small things have really big payoffs over time. And that program, you know, as it's evolved, has now since become what we call our community hub that has a lot more agencies around it. Now we have community health workers in it. And again, it was a beginning for us just to learn what we didn't know and what we couldn't see that was going on in people's lives.
Wow. I think it's really interesting that both of your examples really touch on this idea around education, right? Education for future workforce, education for patients that might be in your community, and thinking about driving that knowledge and awareness and bringing people in as well. And I think it's really fascinating that both of those examples too are looking not just for the here and now, but really setting the stage for future and thinking about who the future caregivers might be, who future clinicians, even in your systems and within your membership. So what great examples of thinking outside the box and bringing in members of the community into solutions. So I think that that's a really great place for us to, you know, continue our discussion around innovation. And Rochelle, I know you had mentioned this earlier on, that experimentation is such a central factor in changing how we approach rural health challenges. And trial and error is unavoidable, right? And sometimes it can be scary to take a leap and try something new. Jaylene, I'm wondering, how do you see your members or your association even finding the balance between taking a risk on creative solutions and needing some degree of confidence that they'll actually benefit?
Well, Rochelle actually brought up a great topic, which is population health. For a very long time, nursing homes have really been on the sidelines of population health. While they might have participated in an ACO like knee or hip program, they really weren't very engaged or the beneficiaries of participating. And so when I think about population health, we have members who have taken the leap. First, we have some who are like what I would call all in, and they've gone the ISNP route. Mm-hmm. And I might be speaking in acronyms that people don't know, but it's essentially the provider absorbing all the risk and becoming their own managed Medicare plan, and they're managing their population that lives with them. That's a big risk to jump off, right? That's from a provider's sake, that's a heavy lift sometimes. So we have providers who have gone that direction, but then now we have other programs. There's a pilot program called an ACO Reach program. And that is a really exciting program where we have providers who are able to jump in that population health world without that entire level of that capitated risk. And so I think as population health evolves, that is one area of innovation and payment model that our members are starting to say, again, path forward. Like, we need to be more engaged in the population health model in order to be sustainable, but also it's now avenues where there's levels of risk that you can take, mm-hmm. to where you can engage with those.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I think we are seeing a lot of interest in maybe dipping a toe into some of these value-based arrangements, or maybe not going fully into innovation even, but thinking a little bit differently and staying within a comfort zone in some areas. Were you finding, Jaylene, that there were certain types of facilities or providers that were more likely to engage with value-based care?
You know, I think we all in our industry have those who are willing to be the leaders. I definitely providers who have embraced quality mm-hmm. all along their journey. You know, I think those were the ones at the forefront because they felt very confident that that's what their focus has traditionally been. You know, those were the ones that I think were on the leading edge, specifically when it comes to iSNP. Because you, again, if you're jumping in the iSNP pool, you have to be very confident in your ability to deliver on quality. Mm-hmm. So, you know, those were the ones I would say that probably leapt first in that pool.
Sure. So having some experience, some, you know, prior background in the areas of consideration, yeah. that sounds right. And so you mentioned around, you know, financial risk and some of the considerations around that. And we know that financial status can certainly play a large role in trying new things. Rural providers are up against many competing priorities. And so that is just a reality. Richelle, can you share your thoughts on the role of just the financial realities in thinking about innovating?
We often will hear, you know, we can't afford to do this or we can't afford to do that. My comeback is you can't afford not to. And I think, you know, while we saw even pre-COVID, you know, lots of different stressors and, you know, things like that. I mean, I think that's, you know, a key job, you know, of leadership is like, how are we going to break through and what are we envisioning, you know, for the future? So, you know, I will talk to colleagues of mine around the state and say, okay, well, you know, what's next? Where does this model go? Where does, you know, what does critical access look like in the hospital of the future, you know, or long-term care. We, you know, a lot of us have those long-term care facilities or, you know, home care or anything, because I think at the comfort zone is to stay just doing what we're doing because it's what we know. And oftentimes if it's like holding together, you know, then like, let's not rock the boat. But I think that what we're not seeing underneath of that is like how much duct tape and twine is holding some of this together. And it's going to, and it's already unraveling. So like post-COVID, it's unraveling. And if we take and look at all of the issues today, okay, so we've talked a little bit about workforce, but the reimbursement gap with the demographics, you know, catching up, and we're seeing more Medicare, Medicaid coming in. Whether you're, well, nursing homes, you have Medicare, Medicaid. Hospitals, you know, you live on commercial, you know, because that's got to balance things out. And that's like the declining, you know, enrollment, the declining, you know, business that we have. And so kind of when I think about, you know, the quotes that we've all heard, you know, necessity is the mother of invention. We have that environment right now. We don't really have a choice. And so, again, I think it's about embracing all of that. And, you know, we have to think about like even our financial resources, you know, and we have those challenges every day here. It's like, okay, we, you know, we have a position we need to fill. What's the position of the future that we need, not the position for right now, you know, and we have to differentiate, you know, different kinds of roles and work and things like that. So for us, it's like continuously thinking about redesigning jobs, redesigning the work, looking at the workflows, you know, all of those kinds of things, because the reality is our financial situation has changed, you know, while we're sitting right in the middle of it. And we need the future state to be one that is more sustainable, but it's not going to be going backwards. It's not going to come and meet us, you know, where we are. And, you know, one of my things that I constantly work on is we have such misalignment in incentives between payers and providers mm-hmm. and even patients to some degree. Like, how do we get that alignment? And this is why, you know, when we were just, you know, talking a little bit about, you know, population health, why I think it's such the sweet spot. Number one, because I think that's the scope of work that, you know, rural does extraordinarily well. And so we should be building on that strength and doing more. But I also think that we can get closer into alignment between providers and payers and patients around the delivery of care and how we can do it and how we can innovate around that and what gets paid for. And, you know, where we deliver care doesn't always have to be inside bricks and mortar. It can be out in the community. And we have that flexibility in rural communities, you know, to maybe tap into some different resources, maybe a little bit more easily because we know what we got and we know what we don't got, you know, and so we've got partners out there and other agencies in our communities and things like that, that we have to think creatively and whether we like it or not, we're going to go kicking and screaming, you know, into this, you know, new future, or we see what's been happening, which is closures. And I'm sure Jaylene can talk about that, but I look at my state and even, you know, across in Wisconsin, you know, nursing home closures that put more pressure than on the hospitals. And we're going the wrong direction that way, right? Because we didn't get ahead of all of that. But that's that necessity that is going to push us. And so we can't have any excuses. And it can't be, I can't afford to change. You can't afford not to change. But again, it's like have a vision for it. And then just move, because something's going to work and something's not. But staying in one place, we know for sure, isn't going to move anybody.
That point about alignment, I think, is so critical. We see that not only in, you know, these unique value-based arrangements, but also just in everyday serving of the patient population, right? Is having that alignment of understanding all the other types of providers that are in the mix and working as a team. I'm curious about, Rochelle, how that can be supported. Is that alignment or those attempts at aligning for goals, is it happening organically? Do the stakeholders need to, you know, come together and be intentional about those types of things? How does that play out?
It's a bit of a mountain to climb because everybody doesn't start, you know, the same place. And today's environment is making everybody a little, you know, even more agitated. But we got involved, you know, back in 2016 in doing the ACO work, mm-hmm. you know, for the Medicare population and the hospital and all of that. So that's been great. And we've been doing that. We were in Medicaid with the state before that. So the government payers, we were already doing that work. And I would say, actually, they've been pretty good partners as far as all that goes, you know, and we get good information back. And all of this is about, you know, needing to have really good data so you understand what's happening and then you get down into the why. But then I reached out to, you know, our largest payer and I said, you know, because there was a presentation they had given, the CEO had given about kind of value-based and all of this. And I said, well, you know, if you're looking for a partner to practice some of this on, we're in. What I found was they needed to have somebody to help understand what does it look like? You know, honestly, payers they're not in our environment. So they're not delivering care. They don't understand, you know, all of the issues that, you know, we face on any given day, the flows of different things, the work. They're just, you know, when they say, go collect all this quality data, I don't think they really understand the work involved in doing that and changing metrics and seeing change happen. And that was a lot of the insights we could provide and challenge them on. But there was an open, you know, leader there, you know, to that work. And we've continued that to this day. But I've also gone back and said, we're pulling out of a couple of these because you can't deliver on the data. And if you can't, then we can't fly blind and we can't put ourselves at risk. So you have to do your part for us to do ours. And I think that's just all of our organizations and systems. You know, we all have our strengths and weaknesses, and everybody's got to kind of get their act together to be able to do this work. I think it is a tough time right now to get this alignment because everybody is looking at who has the money. You know, the government has the money and they should pay for this. You know, the insurers they're collecting all the premiums. They have this. We're getting denials. You're not paying us our money. You know, I think they're looking like we want to control patients and tell them there's better ways for you to improve your health and go to the hospital or whatever. So we have more negative incentives than we do positive ones. So I think it's a conversation we elevate more, which is, you know, for us all to be successful, we should all be thinking about how do we make each other successful? Mm-hmm. Because if we're doing lose, 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 you know, then we're all, of course, losing, right? So we should be thinking about win, win, win. You know, I got to give something to get something, but if it floats my boat, then I'm in a better place than I was before. It's like constant conversation, and there are some dead ears to that right now. But I think also, when that pressure continues to get tougher and tougher, I think then you start getting breakthroughs like, I can't do this anymore. I need to do something else. Okay, now I'm listening. What could we do?
Right, right. It goes back to, Jaylene, your point about breaking down silos and thinking holistically. I do want to move into kind of the government role and how federal agencies can support. But Jaylene, I wanted to just give you an opportunity to maybe comment on this alignment concept and incentives from your perspective.
It's a great example. So our association and our membership chose to, at the beginning of last year, create what's called a provider network. I think similar to a physician provider network, where it's Nebraska Healthcare Quality Partners. And it really, it's individuals coming together to say, all of us, even though we're competitors, we are all going to pursue quality by sharing data, sharing best practices. And that's going to give us the ability to talk to payers, to have conversations around value-based care. And we know it's for the collective good, completely to your point. This is how we need to be acting to move forward. It cannot be everybody's trying to do this on their own. If we come together around quality, all of us can improve. And that is what we need.
Yeah, thinking outside of your own silo, and like you were saying, just kind of zooming out and taking that more comprehensive perspective. I think that's a really important lens to look at a lot of the discussion around innovation too. Well, so both of you have mentioned that it might not typically be feasible for a single provider, whether it be a nursing home, a hospital, a primary care practice, a clinic, et cetera, to go it alone when it comes to innovating. And so we talked a little bit about federal government. Jaylene, I'd be interested to hear what ways the federal government can support developing and implementing and sustaining creative approaches to improving rural health.
I feel like we could do a whole podcast on just this topic, because for us, yeah, you know, we are in a crisis in Nebraska when it's coming to access. We have 17 counties that do not have a nursing home. And these are in counties that the population is aging. So we have to start coming up with more concrete, systematic approaches to be addressing this. So one that I love is trying to copy what was a great idea that was successful in critical access hospitals. Do we designate critical access nursing homes? Mm. Is there a different level of regulation that's needed? I frequently tell policymakers, I understand the need for the regulations of nursing homes, but when you have a facility that is taking care of 25 people, to employ the required individuals, an infection prevention nurse, a full-time director of nursing, a full-time dietary manager, these positions that theoretically could maybe be spread over multiple facilities in that rural area where it's really hard to be financially sustainable to take care of 25 people. And that is something that I think from a regulatory perspective, is there somewhere we could come up with? Is there something as such that is a critical access nursing home? On the flip side of that, you know, is there a sustainable model where we take down the barriers of you are a nursing home and, you know, this is home health? And do we overlay that community that has 500 people in it and a nursing home? And is that community helping manage that population of health? Or is that nurse in that nursing home watching med management for an elder that's still living in their community? Is the maintenance guy doing once a month cleanup for elders who live in that community? And how can we overlay payment models and get away from, well, you're the nursing home, so you can't accept home health dollars? So those are like big picture things that I think about from a federal policy perspective that we could do that could be sustainable and that would benefit not one population, right? It would help the sustainability of that entire community.
Such interesting ideas around maybe some regulatory opportunities, but also, again, this idea of breaking down barriers, whether that be from a payment and facility perspective, working together alongside decision makers too, in addition to other members of the communities. Rochelle, from your perspective, any opportunities you see or ways in which the federal government can support rural health innovation?
You know, I really liked Jaylene's comments. I've thought similarly, you know, maybe starting from a different angle. For example, like we have swing beds in our hospital, which are essentially skilled nursing inside the hospital, right? And so it's like, but you have these designations and so much regulatory, you know, things. And it's like, oh, everybody has to separate. And we ask so much of staff to have to remember, you know, all of these like really specific things so you don't get caught in the trap, you know, or whatever. But yeah, how do you get more of that continuum? And how does somebody just move? Do you really have to move a bed in a room and a this or that? Or how can you tap into the resources and be a lot more flexible? And I think this comes back to this alignment. If this is the pot of dollars we have, then let's use them the best way that we can for the people that need it. Not everybody in my community needs to be in the hospital or in the nursing home or at getting home care or this or that. Let us understand, you know, we understand our community. We understand the resources we have, the workforce we have, the you know, equipment, the everything. And let us, you know, have more flexibility to do what's needed, you know, for the people in our community. Now, what that takes is allowing us to do that, right? So, I mean, I've always thought, you know, CMMI, they tend to want like bigger pockets. We need 20 states to do this, or we need, you know, 400 of these or some of those. But, you know, what's the glide path to change? All of us, if we're going to, you know, do less hospital, for example, because actually so much stuff is moved to outpatient, I don't need all of the infrastructure I have. How can I have more flexibility with some of those things? And how can I just try some stuff? I can tell you without a doubt, we know that there are better ways. And I think we can learn, you know, a lot about practicing with that. So if they'd open the doors a little bit more, if they'd put some funding in there to say, you know what, that sounds like a really good exercise, go do it. We can't fund it because that goes to our viability, right? We just don't have the extra resources laying around, but we know what can be done. So give us some money. Let us do it. Let us prove out some things. I know some of it will work and some of it will have been just a good idea.
Yeah, you've both touched on this idea of really knowing your own community and being the expert in your own lived experience, frankly, in rural areas. And in order to include that in innovating, rural voices are necessary, right? And so, Jaylene, maybe I can pose this to you. How do you think that leaders in rural areas in the healthcare space, how can they engage better with federal decision makers so that those voices are amplified and their unique contexts are taken into consideration?
One, the beauty of living in a rural state is you do have access to your elected officials. We have 5 federal delegates. We have 2 senators and 3 congressmen. And like many rural states, I guarantee the degree of separation is less than 2. You know, it doesn't take much to get connected. And they're still very connected to their community. So engaging in the process is critical. Every year we take, we do a trip to DC and we take 3 direct care staff. So we literally take CNAs, MedAids, activities directors, and it never ceases to amaze me that once they're there talking to one of their elected officials, they walk out and they're like, well, that, like, I just made a difference. And they heard me and they know they actually received their Nebraskans. They are like me. So just raising your voice is really critical. I also think we have to constantly, in our world, in long-term care, we do not have the greatest perception, right? That's not a secret. Mm-hmm. We have to find new ways to constantly raise our voice. Us as an association launched a docuseries this year. It's titled People Worth Caring About. And it is taking a completely different look, what I would call a real true lens. It's a 7-part series, and each episode is 15 minutes long. It's taken all over the state in nursing homes and assisted living. We have a host, Peter Murphy Lewis. He's like the Mike Rowe, right? Of I picture him. But we wanted a different lens. Like, let's tell this story in a whole new way, which show people what it's really like to work and to live in these communities. And let's not make it these glossy videos that we tend to portray ourselves as. Hospitals do it too, right? We all put out like this very shiny image. And let's show the real story, because truthfully, that is far more moving about who we are, what we do, and the people that we take care of.
Yeah, I absolutely love that. I think that one of the things we've definitely learned throughout this series is that community members and leaders play such a crucial role in informing and shaping policy and making the connections between what they experience on the ground to the decisions that get made outside of their locality. And so what a great example of the value of telling the rural story and making sure that the rural voices are front and center. What a cool concept of a docuseries. I'm wondering, Rochelle, kind of similarly, if you think that there are innovative ways to share successes and lessons learned with different stakeholders, whether that be government decision makers or researchers or peers in the field that you have either seen already or that you'd be excited about.
You know, I think it's really important that we do get our story out, and probably to our detriment, I think, historically, because we never want anybody to think like your hospital's in trouble, right? Or your long-term care facility's in trouble, or, you know, that, because you don't want your community getting worried or upset or, you know, all of that. So we've been like awesome problem solvers and, you know, gluing things together and things like that. But I do think that we're at a time, and I know here in Minnesota, we spend a lot of time, and I've spent a lot of time talking to legislators here across the state, you know, going to the Twin Cities. And we're really fortunate, like with our federal elected officials, again, they're also accessible for us and things, you know, so we take our, you know, materials there and, you know, talk to them about like this issue, that issue. I think what's really important is to give them like, here's a real story. So, you know, recent one I just used this week, you know, with some legislators was that we had a patient in our ER who was critically ill and needed to be transferred to a tertiary hospital. And we have our tertiary partners around us. Throughout that day, we called over 23 hospitals in Minnesota, Wisconsin, Iowa, and South Dakota, and nobody had a bed. It wasn't until shift changed, like later in the evening, kind of cycling back, we found a bed for that patient in Milwaukee. We don't send patients to Milwaukee, right? But we did then. And I think that anybody who thinks that rural is like, you know, an afterthought or like, okay, that's a nice to have, or maybe they don't really need so much stuff out there, or I don't even know what goes through their head. Like, this is a defend in place. I mean, again, post-COVID, it's not just nursing homes that lost beds. Hospitals lost beds. There are wings that are closed. There are, you know, lots of things that aren't there. There isn't the workforce for it. And so where we never used to worry about transferring patients, today, they're often on diversion, the tertiary centers. We can't take that patient. You're going to have to take care of them. So we have to be really good about what because we're now taking higher levels of care, tertiary level, at least having to keep them. It might be for hours. It might be for a day or two until we can find a bed that opens up. But we have the boarding issues. You know, we had a patient here for 62 days just recently. And finally, you know, there was a bed available. So this is stuff I think these are shocking stories, you know, really for people to hear. I know that the legislators were like, what? And I think even in our local community, it's like, well, you guys, you know, it's like, I think we make it look easy. And so they don't think that there's like hard problems that, you know, we're faced with. So I do think that we have to be more bold in really telling, like, here's the situation of where healthcare is. Locally, regionally, nationally, because my experience here is probably not different from, you know, others around the state. And when there's no beds at the inn, there's no beds at the inn. And that's for everybody. And our trauma hospitals up in the Twin Cities, with their full, then what are you going to do, right? And so that puts all this other anxiety on like your ER doctors. What am I going to do with this patient? And then you got to pull everybody internally. Your other doctors are helping out and all of that. So we do a really phenomenal job, but I think understanding the conditions within which this is happening is really important for a lot of stakeholders to understand. And I make a kind of a joke, and I'm not really joking though. So I tell people, you know, you better start training your kids now, because they're going to be the ones taking care of you when you're older. Because if we're not going to have the workforce, if we're not going to have the other kinds of capacity, people are going to have to like think, you know, differently about, especially like our, you know, aging folks. They've just assumed we're always going to be there. But I think recent times has put that into question a little bit.
Yeah. What a powerful, you know, several examples that you shared, Rochelle, of stories that are so significant and poignant for what it means to potentially take some of these facilities for granted and what that can mean for your patients and your community members. So it's really great to hear that you are getting those stories to different decision makers and the pathways that might exist to enable those conversations sound really important from what you've shared. And both of you have surfaced so many great opportunities in rural areas to come together to innovate and think outside the box, but also the realities and challenges that you're up against, whether that be resources, staff, funding, silos, whether they be organizational or bigger boundaries and how we think about health. But I want to kind of, in our last few minutes, think about actions and looking forward as we started around forward thinking and innovation. Jaylene, I'll pose this to you. If decision makers could do one thing today, so if you could prioritize the one big thing to make it easier to develop creative solutions and to really implement change, not just think about it, right, but act on it, what do you think that would be?
It's so hard to pick one. I'll build off of Rochelle's comments, and that would be the concept of fund it and let us try. Mm-hmm. Because it's a very chicken and egg, but without proper funding in whatever mechanism it is, we're not going to survive. Mm-hmm. Like if there's not resources put forth, but it's like, give us some resources and some flexibility to try whatever that might be. If you would like a tangible answer, I would actually go to a workforce one, which would be opening up and increasing the amount of legal immigration that can happen. Mm-hmm. Because Nebraska, the only path forward for workforce is legal immigration. Mm-hmm. And that means more healthcare visas. That means speeding up the process. I guarantee these facilities would not have closed as rapidly had they had workforce, and our membership is very dedicated to looking at immigration as that primary form of how to solve this problem.
I think you're raising important points that the basis of innovating are the fundamental things, the resources, the dollars, and the people to be able to make innovation happen. Rochelle, what about you? What would you prioritize, or what would be your one big thing?
Yeah, I really had thought around this sort of alignment of funding, but it's getting that funding. And I think, you know, maybe hand in hand with that is, just to be practical, is waivers. You know, mm-hmm. just waive these regulations. And like, don't not just let us do it, but don't put up, oh, but there's a regulation that says this can't happen and that mm-hmm. can't, right? You know, so we sort of need a greenfield practice place, you know, to try some of this stuff. We're all smart enough not to do things that are going to be dangerous or, you know, jeopardize patients or, you know, residents or things like that. So, you know, let's take some of the barriers that are out there that never get looked at, wave them, mm-hmm. get them out of the way, and let us like start creating fresh.
Mm-hmm. There was legislation introduced in Nebraska, and it was this concept. It was called a regulatory sandbox. Like, let's just get just one sandbox, and that you get to reimagine those regulations. So I'm sorry that I jumped in, but I just love that concept.
Yeah, no, I think that's great. It's the opportunity to innovate, right? And kind of giving that that agency and that ability to think differently and to have a landing place for that creative thinking, which is really important. So, our final question today. It's been really wonderful to hear from both of you. I want you to, you know, think in the future and looking ahead. What excites you the most about the future of rural healthcare innovation? And is there anything specific that is making you excited, whether that be a trend you're seeing or some recent development that really encourages you about innovation in the rural settings?
I think that rural is more important than it's ever been. And I think for some of the reasons that I was just sharing. And so I think that's starting to be understood. I have, for the first time, like in the last maybe 6 or 8 months, have heard more of our elected officials, both at the state and in Congress, be really deeply concerned about rural and even rural independence, because my organization is independent, and saying we need you to be there, you know. So I am excited about at least that support, you know, being there, which I haven't heard it like that, I guess, you know, necessarily in the past. But I think that there's so many things coming down the pipe. In some ways, I would say it would be nice, you know, if I had 20 more years to work. I don't. But I've had 20 more years, because I think that we are just on the cusp of a shift, of a really big shift. And so the example that I would use, and it was the first time I've been excited about an electronic medical record. And so, you know, there's electronic medicals and they're the bane of our existence and everybody knows it. So I'm not saying anything anybody doesn't know, you know, and it's heavy and it's so much extra work on our providers and our clinicians and all of these things. And, you know, all we're doing is collecting, you know, so much data and they're expensive and so forth. And then just a couple months ago, so we happened to be on the Cerner platform, which was bought by Oracle. Now, Oracle does a lot more. They weren't really in healthcare until they bought Cerner. So they are in all of these other industries where they have innovated and have systems and all of these things. And so, you know, they took their engineers and they went over and they like reimagined the EMR and they did it infused with AI. Hmm. And so now you have the Amazon experience, because I've used that example a lot. What's the Amazon experience, you know, that we can give to patients and our providers, you know, with automation, you know, with all the technology this way? They built it. They built it actually over in England, and now it'll be available this summer. So essentially for our providers and for our patients, and it's a patient-centric approach, not an EMR-centric or a provider-centric, but a patient-centric approach that really is an interface that we don't have to then go back, you know, work the old way. It just draws out of it. It pulls everything like right there, like in minutes. So if anybody has done anything with like ChatGPT or Copilot or any of those things, it's that same kind of a principle, which is like you ask the questions, pull up these things, pull up these. So we're not, you know, data mining, like where is this stuff? And to me, that was a leap. That wasn't just like a little innovation. So innovations can be smaller, they can be huge. It took them a while to build this, but that is a breakthrough innovation. And already, you know, even whatever we implement, they're already, you know, five more versions ahead because they know what the next changes are. So that's like innovation on steroids. Mm-hmm. It's like, we already know because we're listening, we're hearing, and we're fixing those things. So if we think about apps on our phone that always have those updates, it's like that. That's innovation. They're always changing. And, you know, after you do the big thing, then you just do a lot of little ones, right? So I'm like so excited because the very first time in like ever since the EMRs came about, that's the first time I've had a good feeling about them.
Well, there's some dovetailing here with innovation in other sectors, right? The technology sector that goes along with innovating in healthcare. And so that is something to, I think, really look at as all of those industries are evolving over time. But great example of something to look forward to ahead. And Jaylene, what about you? What are you excited about?
I have several things. One, we have one of our providers in our state, and it's in Minnesota as well, is the Good Samaritan Society, which is now partnered with Stanford Health. And they hosted a rural health summit that I was able to attend. And this example of technology and healthcare was like live and in full color there. And it was exciting to hear about. It was interesting because they were like, oh, it's like wearables are yesterday. It's all about injectables. Like, and I'm sitting here going, what? But literally they're like, oh yeah, I have, you know, and like half these physicians there were like, oh yeah, we've got this injectable in already that it's monitoring all these things. So it's amazing how fast technology is moving mm-hmm. forward. But truthfully, what makes me most excited about rural healthcare is the fact that the population we serve, seniors, are aging in the rural parts of the state. And so right now it's very much survival, but there is a very near future where it will be incredibly successful in that rural area because the demand is there. There's a population that will need so many services for seniors that I'm excited because we will not be able to move forward. And all of those things around innovation are all going to come in. Payment models, technology, workforce solutions, those are all there. So I'm excited. I have at least another 20 years. So I get to live through it. I'm really excited to get to live through that.
That's really wonderful to hear. It's always good to sort of end on these things that we're looking forward to because there is so much to look forward to and so much opportunity. And when we think about innovation in rural healthcare, I think that several of the themes that I heard from both of you today are there are these foundational things that are necessary to make innovation happen, right? You have to have some funds, you have to have resources and the right people, maybe the right expertise, but also that there are these unique rural characteristics that you can really leverage, like the coming together and working alongside your community members, telling the story, these really powerful stories of what rural healthcare looks like on the ground, and knowing your population best and really being able to serve them because you have that knowledge so ingrained in what you all do. So it's just been such a pleasure to hear from both of you, understanding the hospital perspective, the bigger system perspective, the long-term care perspective, all of these different ways to think about rural health and thinking differently and outside of the box to serve your patient population. So I can't thank you enough. This is just such a wonderful conversation. I'm excited to see future innovations from both of your organizations and what lies ahead. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I, for one, feel incredibly optimistic about the future of rural health. Throughout not just this conversation, but the entire series, it's been clear that the ideas, passion, and dedication needed for positive change are out there. While the challenges are real and the solutions might vary, through collaboration, teamwork, and innovative thinking, decision makers can put some of the lessons we've uncovered into practice and improve rural health outcomes nationwide. This has been Framing Health's Future, an initiative from the federal health leaders at KPMG. For past episodes, as well as how we can partner with federal agencies as they look to improve rural health, please go to visit.kpmg.us/framinghealthsfuture.